Well, welcome everyone to our Freaky Friday for tonight. The speaker tonight is Dr. Siegfried Hakimi. He is at McGill Biology, and I asked him to give this talk because I had been told that Siegfried knows all about how to stop aging. Well, this is a topic that is very popular and has been popularized in many ways, in literature, in film. The film we've chosen to buttress this talk after Siegfried's presentation is The Curious Life of Benjamin Button. So that will be here, back in here. We are allowed to eat while that movie is on. We've hired an extra porter cleaner to attend to any debris we leave behind. So there'll be a little pause between the end of Siegfried's presentation, about 10 to 15 minutes. You can go over, get your pizza, or there's a premier moisson, there's sushi. A lot of, underneath the library is the closest snack refreshment venue. It is being archived, taped, videotaped tonight by McGill Communications Services very generously for us so that this is not ephemeral, this is not lost. This will be, you will be able to access this talk forever on the World Wide Web. It's actually called Be Cool TV is the link that you go to. Siegfried, after an early career as a professional cyclist, Siegfried obtained a PhD in biology from the University of Geneva in 1988. He carried out his postdoc studies at the Laboratory of Molecular Biology of the Medical Research Council in Cambridge, England. In 1992, he joined the Department of Biology at McGill, where he's been studying the molecular genetics of biological rates and aging. In 1998, Dr. Hakimi founded Chronogen. It's a biotechnology company that, in partnership with McGill, is applying the findings of his laboratory to the search for drugs to fight age-dependent diseases. Siegfried Hakimi is Strathcona Professor of Zoology, and we're very glad to host him for a Freaky Friday. Thanks, Dr. Hakimi.
Thanks for the introduction, and actually with what Ingrid said at the beginning, you know, like the secret of trying to age, not to age or to age slowly. Of course, experiments can go terribly wrong, and I'm actually 20, and something didn't work at all. So you're going to have a way to do this better. What I'm going to speak about today is the process of aging and what we should think about it and what we should not believe about it. What, you know, how does it affect you, or indeed what it means for the animal kingdom. I've been speaking mostly about animals. And the talk is called Worms, Nuts, and You, because one of the organisms we're using a lot in this research, and I'm going to describe some experiments we use with this organism, are this animal here, which is very small, a so-called roundworm, a nematode. They are non-parasitic worms which live in the ground normally, and they're very practical for aging research. You are important because you are the one who are aging, and other people have been aging in the past. This is Saint Jerome, who has reached a fairly old age and is very much a scientist, as I see it, because when he actually retired in the desert to meditate, he took his entire library, which is a funny way of being a hermit, and I think there's a sort of things I try to do in my office. And this is Doris Lessing, which is a Nobel Prize winner in literature, and I thought it's a good illustration also about the problem of aging, because here we see a fairly old lady who clearly has it all together still, and it's kind of nice to see. I'll be speaking a very little bit of about mice. I don't have time to speak more about mice, but almost everything I'm going to discuss about people and worms apply. Some of the experiments we've done seem to be true with mice as well. There's actually a man sitting here who's doing some of that stuff. Okay. Oh, sorry, I just want to precise that. You will see why I have the nuts here. It's because I've been giving some similar talks with some similar data and at other times, and sometimes this one little thing I have to say about nuts is the only thing people remember. So I thought it's a good place in the title. Again, the idea is that we want to study aging, but aging seems to be a very general process. meaning that the patterns of aging, what happens during aging, seems to be very comparable in many ways in a whole range of animals. In fact, probably in all animals. And if we have learned anything from biology in general in the last 30 years, is that the basic biological processes and the molecular aspect of these processes are highly conserved. Okay? And so that we really hope to use different organisms for a variety of different reasons I'm going to comment about, but it's all to find some general truth, not something specific to a particular type of organism. Nonetheless, these organisms are different in some interesting ways. So, for example, Caenorhabditis elegans, we call him the worm, lives only a few days, or if you want, a few weeks. And here we have a lifespan of the wild type of a normal animal, and here's the example of a mutant which is capable of actually living longer than the normal animals. Mice, however, live many more. These are now in weeks in life. Mice actually live many more, much longer time, up to 3 or 4 years. And here, too, we can nonetheless obtain mutants that live substantially longer. People, on the other hand, live up to 100 years. And, of course, it takes a very long time to do any sort of experiment. And so what the sort of, however, people have been looked at in great detail through medicine and because people are interested in themselves. And therefore, we can get some type of information from studying people, different type of information from studying mice, and different type of information from studying worms. But the idea is that all this information at some point has to come together to actually understand basic principles. And I hope that I can show you that some of the things we found out are actually comparable to a certain degree. Now, I have a few of these slides with just a little phrase, and it's just to remind me what I want to talk about, but also to have a little slogan of some question we want to ask and maybe answer. So time is not an anti-vital force. I say that because many people, in their reaction to any data we present or I try to discuss, have this impression that there is something unstoppable about time itself, that what happens to an organism has to do with time. We're really meaning the clock ticking. And I think this impression comes from yet older ideas which are not completely not accepted anymore, which is that living organisms are different in some fundamental way. They're not mechanisms. They do not fully... What happens to them doesn't fully apply. It's not exactly the same what happens to the physical environment. And what allows them to be alive is sort of a vital force. And this is really a 19th century, 18th century notion. And some people still don't have it out of their head. I mean, even nowadays when physicists speak about consciousness, they want to make it totally unbiological. It has to be something to do with the structures of the universe. Consciousness as well is just an emanation of biological processes in the brain. And just as we must be all agree now that there is no vital force in any sort of special, quasi-metaphysical way that animates living organisms, time is not an anti-vital force. So it's not like, organisms live, and of course they're going to be older because time in itself has passed. But I can argue of why I believe this is not the case. The whole idea is that aging, in fact, is degenerative. It's a result of entropy. It's a tendency of organized things to fall apart. Except that in living organisms, they fall apart more slowly and in a kind of specialized way. So what I illustrated here is actually myself to show that really, when I mean falling apart, I mean it. very cute, not so cute, okay? But what's important is this takes a long time, right? It takes a very, very long time. So we're going back to that aging is not like being dead. When you kill an organism, it falls apart very, very, very quickly. This is clearly not what happens during aging. It falls apart slowly. But it's essentially still a falling apart. And we're going to go back as well of, why, what gives the rate of falling apart? Why is it different in different species, etc.? But nonetheless, here I like to say that organized things tend to fall apart, and therefore that what it means is that they accumulate damage, and they accumulate molecular damage. They also accumulate higher level damage, your leg which has been broken and never fully healed. But for the aging process as such, we're talking about molecular damage as well at the cellular level. And of course, when too many of your molecular components have been damaged, your homeostasis, your ability to maintain your organism as it is, functioning when it's not damaged, is going down. And at some point, your homeostasis is just not good enough to survive. Now, sometimes people tell you as well, but you know, say an aged organism who's over 50, he is not like necessarily having a disease. This organism is not dying. So in what way can we say that it's damaged? You know, it's not dying. It's just changed its look. Well, but if I and a 20-year-old fall at the same speed from our bikes, there's a much better chance that I break something and die. Okay. And so homeostasis doesn't manifest itself only through a disease that affects you. It has to do with your ability to survive your environment as well. Okay. Just, you have to realize there's all sorts of way of measuring age in a pathological sense. But to go back to what I said about time is not an anti-aging, it's not an anti-vital force, is that we can completely suppress it. If we take our nematodes here, or indeed even mice embryos, completely living things, okay, totally, and we put them in liquid nitrogen to very cold temperature, they're not aging at all. Time passes in the universe. Time passes in the container. Time still passes. But we keep entropy unable to grow, to increase. And also time passes and the universe is further away from the Big Bang and closer to the Big Crunch. All of this has happened, yet the organism doesn't age at all. These guys, we've lived 3 weeks. We're having some in our liquid nitrogen for 20 years. If you wake them up by warming them up, they go on and live a full lifespan. You can even do little jokes like, you know, you can injure them and then freeze them, leave them 20 years in the liquid nitrogen. They wake up and then die from the injuries. Okay? Now, so again, time per se means nothing. Okay? Something has to happen. What can happen can be very, very quick if there is no mechanism which prevents it from happening, like when an organism is dead, okay, or has been killed. Other things happen as well, and the organism is trying to slow it down, but does not such a bad job in people who live a long time, but nonetheless does only a partial job, but we go back to that. A bad environment is not the cause of aging. Now, I'm trying to say, as you will see, that a bad environment doesn't maybe accelerate your aging or shortens your life or makes you sick earlier. Of course it does. Clearly the reason why people nowadays live almost to 100 and in the Middle Ages didn't is because of the environment. But that's a very different proposition than to say the environment causes aging, because that would imply that in a perfect environment one wouldn't age anymore. Okay, that's not the case, and I want to show you as an example. Everything I'm showing you are example, and not the, you know, writing the book I would be talking a lot longer of why we know these sort of things. And yeah, I come back to a study from about 10 years ago. People have done on Californian Seventh-day Adventists. Now, this is a religious sect in California, and people have worked on this group of people for a reason, which is that they were very homogeneous where they lived. They tended to live in very similar ways. And on average, they were leading healthy lives. Just their habits were healthy lives. So they tried to wonder, wow, these people are a pretty tight group, have healthy lives. Let's compare them to the general Californian population and then try to find out what happens. So the first thing they saw was that they were actually living somewhat longer, and I want to show you, attract your attention right away to the fact that they didn't actually increase maximum lifespan very much, but they did increase the average lifespan. These guys, on average, lived quite a bit longer. You see that there were quite a few more 70-year-olds or 80-year-olds. Now, what they called healthy living was the following things. And what's important to know as well is that, okay, the following things. To be a vegetarian rather than eating meat, to do exercise rather than not doing exercise, to have a low body mass index, that is being slim rather than being fat, to not smoke rather than smoke, to eat nuts or not, okay, and to get hormone replacement therapy. This is a 13-year-old study, and people still were very much thinking that hormone replacement therapy is a good thing. Now, as you know, now there's many questions about hormone replacement therapy for women. They have mostly to do with breast cancer, and they have mostly to do with people who are already at risk of breast cancer. Nonetheless, this is a practice which is coming a bit out of fashion, I would say, but in these days, the impression was that people's cardiovascular health, and that's probably true for cardiovascular health for women, for postmenopausal women, is made better by actually having hormone replacement therapy, so they saw it as something beneficial people could do or not. And apparently, Seventh-day Adventists did some of that. The other thing I have to point out to understand the meaning of the study is that it's not like Seventh-day Adventists all are vegetarian, slim, exercise, don't smoke. It's just, it was a tendency in this group. Okay, and this actually was important to be able to do the analysis I'm going to show you. Okay, so what people did to analyze this is the following. They first of all looked at what the average age of death for those people who, for all the different values of exercise, of say a baseline, that's the average amount of exercise people had in this group, but among those some people had a lot of exercise, and others had very little exercise. Okay, so they tried to compare these three things, the average versus those who had a lot of exercise and those who had little exercise. But otherwise, it's all the same group, and that allows the comparison to maybe be rigorous. And so they just know what's the average. If you take everybody, the average age here at, these people could live to was about 85 years. And then the way this graph works is you're adding more and more risk. Then they compared those who had everything at baseline, except the baseline for all the different things, except vegetarian status. Now they look at the baseline for everything and compare those who have a very good vegetarians, they eat only broccoli, day and night, and those who are at high risk, they don't eat any broccoli, they only eat red meat with gravy. And they see that starts to make a difference. So all those you compare in the group, everything else is the same as the average group, right? You actually, even if in the average group you start eating meat, a lot of meat and not any vegetable, you start losing lifespan. If you now take, and this is additive, if you take those who, these guys now, as those who are vegetarian and they exercise, and these guys as those who are neither vegetarian nor exercise, essentially, and these guys are exercising, a vegetarian and eat nuts, and these are not eating nuts, are not vegetarian, and are not exercising. And these are all the same, and on top of their fat, and these used to smoke. Okay. And what it shows you something very interesting is that, and really, your grandmother, great grandmother, we all knew that. Once you do everything reasonably, okay, it's hard to improve on that. Now, so, and the only thing that's why. The only thing which seems to improve on that is eating nuts. So, in this particular study, okay, I mean, here, whatever you do, you're the best vegetarian, you're the best exerciser, you're the best nut eater, you're the best BMI eater, and it changes very little compared to the average for everything. Only being a crazy nut eater seemed to be making an effect. However, if you do all the wrong things, that makes a big difference. Okay, this makes a difference of 11 years. Okay, while these are still people who are, we compare them among a group, but a lot of people are also parent to each other, they sort of live in the same place, they're in the same part of the 20th century, they live during the same sort of time, right? And in spite of all that, you can still find out that those who misbehave, it will actually kill you. So it's interesting because we all knew that, okay? We knew that, sort of, we had a feeling that, once you're very reasonable, to be extra good can't make a big difference. However, if you're extra bad for everything, well, it's not so good. But it also tells you, I think, especially the flatness of the blue curve, that the environment doesn't determine lifespan. It can shorten it, but a perfect environment will not suddenly make you live forever, okay? Because you're not programmed that way. And, you know, many of the, not all of it, but many of the examples or slides or concepts I want to transmit have to do with questions I have sometimes had a million times, you know. Yeah, but what if I, well, it won't help. Okay. Now we can go back in a way, having this out of the way, and say, why do people age anyways? I mean, why is it people? Why do animals age? Why do most organisms age? And we won't have time today to talk about some organism which may be not aging. We're not even sure, and it's complicated. But why most organisms age, and why is it necessary? One thing is to describe how they age. One thing is to describe the difference between the species. One thing is to describe what could be the physiological basis between this difference, all of that. But it doesn't tell us why is it apparently necessary, because they all do. Okay? So it's intrinsic of being an animal is to age. Well, they all do. And the reason for this is actually evolutionary. Okay? There's an evolutionary cause of aging. It has to do with what it means to be a living organism with a genome. Okay? And I want to give you a few examples. Again, the illustrations of something which I could also explain, or maybe I couldn't, but some people could explain mathematically what's actually happening. And the starting point reason is that the survival of the individual is not necessary to the survival of the species. We can many species. The human species is around, and most people, it's actually not true. I was going to say most people who ever lived that have died, it's actually not true. Most people who ever lived are alive today, which is weird. It's just because there are so many. That's a different question. So it's not necessary as a species. And I'll give you a few examples of why that is. First, an intro to this example, which is a bit more abstract. Well, you know, we have access to a certain amount of energy or resources. You call it whatever you want, okay? Either because we can eat them, grab them, or we have reserves in our body, or we have been built with exact specification. It's a form of reserve. It's a form of something you can use. And we have to do two things with this. If you don't want to fall apart instantly, as I said, as when you kill an organism, well, you need some form of repair, and we already discussed and insisted that clearly organisms do some form of repair. They don't fall apart instantly as a non-living body. You need some form, but as well, you need to reproduce. And so, well, both repair, which is necessary because of entropy, and reproduction use energy, or again, I could have replaced the word energy here by resources. And what it means, therefore, is that when you look at the amount of energy used for reproduction, and yes, the 50-50 is just an example. I'm not particularly saying it's 50-50, but I mean, it's not all the energy because part of it is used for something else. Therefore, reproduction is actually slower than could be. Similarly, we're not using all the energy for repair, so the deterioration is actually faster than it could be because you can't use all your resources for repair if you still want to reproduce. Okay, but why does this induce aging? Okay. Well, it's obvious it's because repair is not perfect, but why is it not a good idea? Why is it not a good strategy to have a perfectly repaired body, you know, and then, of course, less energy is left for reproducing, and so you reproduce more slowly. What's the problem? Everybody will be immortal forever. The problem is the following. The problem is competition. So you have to imagine a woman with perfect repair. And it's a woman because women are pretty essential for reproduction. And therefore, this woman here, she's non-aging, okay? But she's non-aging doesn't make her immortal. Why? Because there's something you just can't remove from the environment, like predation and gravity. I mean, like, you can fall down from somewhere and die. It's great to have a perfectly repaired body, which will remain intact forever and ever, and have spent all your energy for it. Your loss is absolute when you die, okay? Maybe nonetheless, you're on a planet where everybody's like that, maybe it still could go on and you reproduce slowly and you try to minimize the loss, etc. But if on that same planet there's a woman with imperfect repair and which accumulates damage and therefore ages, but this allows her to have more progeny, then in spite of the loss of this poor thing, she will end up having more living progeny. And therefore, the group of these organisms will outcompete these guys in absolutely no time whatsoever. Okay? So you cannot just go and say, you know, and be comfortable to live a long time, because if anybody else thinks, yeah, never mind comfort, I'm going to reproduce faster, also, of course, there's no volition in there, this is a problem. So the fact that there's necessary loss and that there's so-called antagonistic pleiotropy, that you cannot have both things at the same time, creates an equilibrium which is different, of course, for organisms which live in different niches. And I come back to that. I want to give you a completely different example to illustrate the same thing. It's not, no, it's a completely different illustration to say the same thing. And again, it has to do with the preeminence of reproduction. Let's just imagine an individual of a species that's immortal, that arrows to mean is going on and on forever. And it reproduces with whatever left energy it has, given that it does perfect repair, at regular intervals, right? Easy thing to imagine. And you have to remember, though, however, that this new individual, which has been reproduced, is growing up, and now is reproducing as well, and it's immortal, and does this at regular interval, and its first offspring does the same, right, etc. And so after a while, you have a whole army, right? That's why I took somebody in a uniform. Now, imagine a mutant, an organism that's different, that's capable to actually reproduce twice as often. So it produces both the blue and the red. Now you have an even larger army, okay? Now, maybe this organism, its ability to do this means that it's costly to its ability to repair itself, okay? And therefore, after a certain time, in contrast to the blue guy, okay, the red organism dies, okay? It dies, it can't live forever, you having this very high level of reproduction, okay? But what does it mean? It means that, say, at the moment where it dies, everything here is equal. The only difference when this mother of the whole population dies is that one less individual is produced here. Right? All the rest is the same. Right? They're still alive. They're still reproducing. The only difference at the time of death between the situation where you have only the blue and you have the blue and the red is this one blue who doesn't get born, which means that it's totally irrelevant in the population. It's like it's a blip. Right? This whole army keeps being there and reproducing. At that time, the only difference from having this one die because he wasn't perfect is this one individual die. Okay? So, that's why as well, okay, and for this reason, if a mutation did arise, which allows this double reproduction, it would actually not be eliminated. It's a good mutation, okay? Now, of course, if the mutation makes you die right away after you are produced only half a child, that wouldn't be good, and such a mutation would not foster. But that's why there is an equilibrium between how much you invest in repair and how much you invest in reproduction, because the idea that you just can invest more in repair and then reproduce for longer just doesn't work, because if you have already been reproducing for a long time, then your contribution after a while is nothing at all. Okay? It's the technical, well, one way this is called as well is also it's a decrease of the force of natural selection when you have started reproducing. As soon as you reproduce, there is less incentive for your genotype to keep you alive, because you've already managed to reproduce. And so that's more important than anything. Okay? But we can see in this quasi-numerical thought process that how this works. I was going to say something, but now it escapes. Okay. So we just move on. There is an unresolved relationship between aging and age-dependent disease. You know, clearly, when you're young, you're fine. You're old, nothing works anymore. But it's not completely uniform. Some things work less well than others. And something will kill you, others not so obviously. And what will kill you depends on the niche you live in and others not, etc. And even it's hard a bit to debate of what is an age-dependent disease. Mostly we think of age-dependent diseases as things that can kill you. Atherosclerosis, cancer, diabetes, neurodegenerative diseases. Okay? And we do not think of age-dependent diseases as markers of aging which you think can't kill you. Say, when your skin starts to be older and less elastic, you think that's just a mark of aging. It's not a disease. It's not a disease for us. But if you're on all fours all day, try to find berries in prickly bushes, okay, and you're getting cuts all the time that have to heal, that have to not get infected, that have to scar properly, then this can kill you. Okay? And actually some very, very old people die from very simple superficial wounds that never cure. Okay? And so even what the age-dependent disease is not clear. Just things become dysfunctional, and that's what we call an age-dependent disease, and they just become dysfunctional with time. Some diseases are not age-dependent. Okay? Some of them are. Nowadays, we speak a lot about neurodegenerative diseases as an age-dependent disease because they have a very steep aging dependence. Basically, very few people have any sort of cognitive problem before the age of 70. But then between 70 and 65, it goes up to 50%. Okay, a very sharp one, so it really feels as age-dependent. But in fact, the heart problems, the cancer, all of them are very age-dependent as well. You constantly lose the function of your kidney, you're just not noticing, because the way we live, we don't need that much kidney function. Different environments, you might need more of your kidney. Anyway, so I want to explore what's the relation between age and age dependencies. And there are two models which I think we don't yet know which is the right model, and it's even hard to exactly describe what's the difference between the models, but sometimes like that, okay? Sometimes you have to make up the question in order to see if you can find an answer, and that's going to make the question a better question, okay? One is whether, you know, all these diseases I was talking about, they all have their own cause. Out of the things that go wrong in the organism, there are independent paths of going wrong, okay? And then some way of going wrong produces one type of disease, and some other way of going wrong produces another. And these are almost independent processes. Different parts of your molecular setup are not working. And so it's possible it's what we call aging. Oh, this is an aged organism. It's really only the sum of all these independent processes that go wrong. Okay. Another possibility, and again, it's not that easy to conceptual rigorous about this, is that aging is a process in itself. Something happens in the body, we don't know what it is, it's bad. Say, accumulation of somatic mutation, accumulation of mutation in the DNA in all the cells of your body, which each one of them is not a problem, but when they finally accumulate everywhere, then at various moments they lead to the dysfunction of a particular organ system or something. Right? So distinguishing between, is that just a word, is aging just a word to describe all that, or is it actually sort of occult process behind these manifestations? Okay. And it's a worthwhile question to ask. And now I just have a few illustrations to explore what it kind of means, whether we think one thing or another, okay? So let's imagine that aging, or that we're just looking at a number of independent degenerative processes. So this one tends to start early in time, and this one later, this one at intermediate time, this one's the latest, and this one very late. And so because there are these degenerative processes and they're bad for you, well, somewhere during that period the organism will die from one of them or from all of them together, okay? And we know some of them, you know. And because I want A, B, C, D, I couldn't find anything. So this is a psychological disease. So, you know, we know some of them. Atherosclerosis definitely kills you. Sometimes starts pretty early. Diabetes, cancer. Alzheimer's, we know as well, neurodegenerative disease, and it kills you pretty late. It kills you late. Okay? What it tells you already is that you have to escape to all of those to actually get Alzheimer's. And that's maybe a bit what happens nowadays because people live much longer, so you actually get there. So now let's imagine we found silver bullet against atherosclerosis, okay? Very specific problem about atherosclerosis, which we know how to cure it. What happens is that you're going to live only a very little bit longer, right? Because you're still killed by the others, except that your probability to make a bit longer is better because that one doesn't kick in, okay? And in fact, it's been calculated that if, not bad, but if you could cure all people of cancer forever, I mean, or prevent them ever to have it, the average lifespan would increase only by 7 years, which is a lot if you aren't, but still, you know, it's not like it changes that much, okay? It goes so far that nowadays, finally, for prostate cancer, people very often do not get surgery for the very simple reason that the prognosis of survival with the prostate cancer is longer than the chance to die from one of the other things they've got. And who wants surgery and all the stuff which goes with it? So if likely you're going to die from something else, I know, no reason to intervene, okay? Of course, not everybody's in this situation. It has to do with your whole health status and the particular cancer you have and so on, okay? So, but just to say, you know, that's a clear example. Now, we could also imagine that we learn to cure one, the next, et cetera, and we can do that in two ways. We can either find different cures for each of these things, and what then would happen is everybody dies of Alzheimer's. And it's a bit what's happening. I'm exaggerating to give examples, but I mean people speak of epidemia of Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases because people reach these high ages. Okay? I mean, in the Middle Ages, nobody had Alzheimer's. It's true. But the other way to cure all of that and to live to Alzheimer's is actually to find a way to not cure each disease, but actually prevent them from happening, right? So if the model, this model is true, maybe we can intervene on this and then preventing all of them from happening, right? Okay, so the one way would be then to intervene on a sort of the source of all the evil, right, at once. And then maybe you know, you can get all these, and maybe Alzheimer's is something else. It's aluminium. It's not actually an age-dependent disease, and everybody does have Alzheimer's just the same. But I want to make another point here. This is also already happening. People are much less sick than before of a variety of things. And we found the cure for all these diseases, which is having an easy life. Don't smoke. Don't eat too much. Don't work too hard. Be sheltered. Have sanitation in the streets or pay your taxes, please. All these things which made people live longer, much longer, people have increased the lifespan threefold in the last 300 years, essentially from sanitation. I mean, like, just sanitation, more food, just having enough to eat, not being exposed to the cold, and not working like an animal day and night to make a meager living. And people in westernized society live a very long time, probably for these very simple reasons. We've actually not changed aging. We slowed this rate a bit down. Just as I said, the environment doesn't cause aging. Certainly you can modulate it. Okay? But, of course, the holy grail would be to find something, you know, people want to take a pill. So a pill which makes you live forever. Okay. Last point is that, as I said, you might live, everybody's going to die for Alzheimer's if you cure everything at once. But of course, it's also possible that if Alzheimer's is just age dependent and we find a way to actually slow down aging, well, that depends how hard we can slow it down, and then you don't develop age dependent diseases. Okay? Now, I want to show you now experimental data that suggests that maybe there is a process that's independent of the diseases it produces, right, which is a process we can look at by itself, and it's bound to affect all these other things. And I'm slow, so I should speed up. One is some work we've done with C. elegans, with worms, and it's the following. Here we have in black here wild-type worms. Ignore these two guys, doesn't matter. And wild-type worms, and you see they're all dead within 20 days. Then we made a mutant strain, okay? this DAF2-CLOK1 mutant strain. And in these animals, in the entire genome of the animal, which has almost irrelevantly large number of base pairs of genes of staff, we changed but two base pairs, two point mutation. We changed slightly the function of two genes only out of the 30,000 genes and many more regulatory sequences in the genome. And this animal lived 5 times longer than the wild type. So sure, you can change a gene, a function, and it has a variety of effects. Sure. I mean, not every gene doesn't have necessarily a very narrow effect. Nonetheless, that you can have such a minimal change in the organism and obtain such a large effect must mean that by whatever you change in the physiology of the animal, you must have impacted all the causes of ages, of death in this animal. It doesn't die. So whatever the reason of dying, and we know some of worms that say, oh, the growths, I don't want to tell you, they die for all sorts of gross reasons, but they all must have changed, from a mechanical rupture to, you know, the equivalent of the kidney not working, for any infection, you know, they live in bacteria which they consume. I mean, all of this is much better, because these guys who live normally only 20 days, they must have been terribly over-engineered. Or there's something we don't get. And we might actually have touched on the rate of living, on the rate of aging, and every consequence which normally kills them much faster has been affected. Now, that's the sort of data which makes you wonder, you know, maybe that there is maybe such a thing in the aging process, and maybe it can be, worked on. This very briefly to show you that we have essentially very similar data with mice. This is not something just to do with worms. With mice, we don't get effects which are as large, and they're also harder to get. It takes 3 or 4 years to do the experiment compared to a few weeks, and costs a lot of money, and there are lots of problems. But you can see how this mutant, MCLOK1, and these are heterozygotes, they just have lower levels of one gene, and all that counts in red are the males, just to say that it works for both males and females. How these guys, there's some early deaths, which is interesting, actually, not going to discuss it, but how they live on average quite a bit longer than the wild type, and in fact, you know, 40% of all of them live longer than any of the wild-type animals. Oh, that's a pretty serious effect. If you had that for people, 2 villages, right? And in one of them, 40% of the people live longer than any has ever reached in the other village. You say, I want to live in this one, right? And so it seems to be we have similar data for mammals and for a model which is applicable, hopefully, to us. Now, again, it's the same vein to show that you can maybe affect everything at once. I want to talk about centenarians. And the idea is that centenarians might actually be long-lived mutants. And to introduce the data which allows us to believe this, I want to check a small point first about heritability. So there's a very simple experiment people did in Sweden where they had long records, and et cetera, and they used twins. They looked monozygotic twins, where the twins are identical, versus dizygotic twins, where they're like fraternal brothers. So they are similar but not identical. And then they looked when this pair of people were dying. And you see that monozygotic and dizygotic twin die roughly at the same age. And this is the average age of death of the population out of which they took these twins. So we're talking about individuals which have a normal lifespan. And if you take an individual who have a normal lifespan, what you find is that the monozygotic twin die at much more at the same time. Okay? This is a correlation coefficient, which means that if the monozygotic twin were to die both on the same day, it would be 1. And if there was absolutely no correlation of one dies and the other, it would be 0. Okay? And you can see that for dizygotic twin is close to 0. I mean, already when your brother dies, your difference in your common genetic background doesn't make much of a difference. But when you are genetically identical, then in fact a third of the variation is not there, because you have the same genes. So what it means is that, and this sort of level of correlation is the one finds for most physiological features, okay? Some have higher heritability, like IQ. You don't like to hear that, it's true. Others, like height, have pretty high as well. It's over 50. But many of the things which we recognize in your brother, sister, parents, the heritability is about that, okay? It means that the amount of the variation which has to do with having the same genes or not. But what it means is that we have an average correlation. And that's for people who have genes which give them average lifespan. And centenarians seem to be different. And to illustrate this, I show you first this pedigrees of, and in red, these are pedigrees of various families, and in red are people who made it to 100. And what you can see is that when two people who made it to 100 marry, there are lots of little children who make it to 100. And if people do not make it to 100 marry, some of them did, you can have. And you have some of this incredible pedigree, look at that. These people made it to 100, and virtually all of the offspring made it to 100. Okay? And the same thing is true here. These are actually two different families. And so you have this huge heritability, meaning that here, it, once you are capable of reaching 100 years, your heritability seems to be very different. You seem to be very capable of transmitting this ability. And this becomes more extraordinary even if you realize that these families, they lived in the 18th century, where the average lifespan was nothing like 100. Okay? I've always something people have to remember when we speak about centenarian, to do any study of centenarian, these are people who are already dead, which means that they lived during different times. Okay? Of course, when you look at even older pedigrees, it's very striking. So that suggests that the ability to live a very long time is actually has a much stronger heritability. It has really to do with your genes. Okay? And now I want to go back to age-dependent disease and health and centenarians. A good health manifest, he says, by long life, and that's very important because people constantly ask me, why would you want, I don't want it. Why would you want to make people live longer if they're then going to suffer for longer from the terrible debilitating diseases? But it's not true. If you're going to make it to a long time, I'm going to show you an example, it means that you're healthy, otherwise you're not making it to a long time. And that can be encapsulated by the fact that you die from the first thing that kills you. So if you have disease that will kill you, you're not going to live beyond that. So one point about centenarians is that they're special, okay? They're special in many ways. First of all, they live 200 years. It's very heritable. That's why I showed two brother-sister pair. It's very heritable. Very often there are a couple of siblings which all make it to 100. They tend to be in a good mood. So, of course, this is anecdotal or apocryphal, but my friend Tom Perls here, the guy in Boston who's a specialist in centenarian, does very good work, shows always these movies and suggests always these are people who have a good attitude. Okay, of course, we don't know if they're just too happy to be 100 and you're not. That's what makes them really happy. Or if already the good attitude was part of and allowed them to make 200. But this is an interesting, if anecdotal, observation. This is a member, former member of our department, Dr. Clark Fraser, and he made it almost to 100. And at 98, I still was telling hello to him in the corridor when he was picking up his scientific correspondence. You know, he was special in the sense that the degree to which he was totally still present intellectually and even as an active scientist was extreme. This is Jean Calment, some of you have heard about, who made 122, which is a very long life. But I want to use this as an illustration as well. It's a very strange observation. How rigorous it is, we don't know yet. People try to make it as rigorous as possible. Is that the risk factors for us to make it more or less to a high age don't apply to centenarian. So for people, for most people, smoking is bad for you. Being obese is bad for you. Doing no exercise is bad for you. For those who make it to 100, maybe not. So they're sufficiently different that the things that shorten our lives don't shorten theirs. And that's weird, okay? And it's not completely resolved, and it's not even clear that it's completely true. But it seems to be, for now, an anecdotal observation. The metabolism is sufficiently different, right, that what precipitates you doesn't necessarily precipitate them. Okay. The other thing is, and very important, centenarians are healthy. They made a very rigorous study. They took 469 unrelated centenarians. I mean, they were not siblings or anything. And they looked at heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and cancer in their previous life, while they were alive, and when did they develop these diseases, okay? What they found is that out of all the centenarians, only 13% were survivors, meaning they had developed one of these diseases and then still made it to 100. And mostly this is cancer, because you can cut it out. Okay. And the others all are the layers, which means that basically they've been diagnosed maybe in the last few percent of the lifespan, or they were escaper. They never developed, obviously, one of the things which now we would use to us, which would be, you know, on the death certificate of somebody who died. Doesn't mean they didn't have some of it in there, but it's not the way it worked. A single disease like that, so which is going to kill most of us, didn't kill them. Centenarians just are very healthy. And that's why I'm saying that if we find ever a way to more systematically, except through behavioral, behavioral adjustments, to make people live a longer time, it would mean that they will live a longer time and being healthy. Because once you have Alzheimer's, diabetes, and heart disease, you're not going to live very long. So if you're starting with 70, it's just not true that the miracle pill will make you live now to 100. This is, again, the thinking that time is an anti-vital force, and I'm boosting your vital force, but you're going to be still alive, but suffering, having terrible disease. It's just, it's not rational, okay? And actually, the data shows that's not true. Okay. I want to give another example because I like it. So in this study, what people did, they took centenarians. They had already died, otherwise you wouldn't know the centenarians. And equivalent 73-year-olds, not those who were 73-year-olds, but who had died at the age of 73. So the two groups are those who made it to 100 and those who made it only to 73. And they tried to make this group as similar as possible, from the same village, from the same socioeconomic class, etc. I mean, I tried to match them as best as they could. And then they looked at women only. And then they looked at whether these women had a child after the age of 35 or even after the age of 40. And what you find is that those who will later make it to 100, many more of them had a child after the age of 35, and even many, many more compared to the other group had a child after the age of 40. And this is particularly interesting because childbirth by itself slightly reduces your lifespan. Small effect. Okay. What it means is that when you make it to 100, you have been young physiologically your entire life. So when you want to know about yourself, if you're going to make it to 100, what you have to do is watch in the mirror and how you go downstairs and how thick your glasses are and how gray your hair is and how bushy your eyebrows, and you get sort of an evaluation. Because, in fact, to live long, you can't be old and then stay there, okay? You have to be younger all the time, sir, okay? And there's some people, and centenarianship is actually heritable, as we've seen, and people study nowadays the offspring of centenarians. And so you can make a picture of somebody who has a good chance to be a centenarian because, you know, his dad and mom both were. And some of these people look so young, it is staggering. I mean, really it is. You know, you think it's a 40-year-old, it's 70. And I think it's an important point, again, to show that, you know, you can't just be old, go old, and at 80 it stops, okay? It's not happening. Okay. And this is just another way, I'm being a bit heavy here, there's a way to illustrate this, and I'm going to skip it. Well, because I want to go to the last point, which is, we talked about aging and age-dependent diseases, and is there an independent process which causes the diseases, or is it a collection of diseases? That's one type of question. Another type of question, which applies particularly to the idea that aging is an independent diseases of the independent process of the disease it creates, but also applies to the other model, is whether there are multiple causes or a single cause, right? So is there one thing that really causes aging, or indeed are there multiple causes which all together end up making the organism age? And really there's only one cause which has ever been proposed to be the cause of aging, and that's free radicals, oxidative stress. Free radicals are, free radicals are oxygen-containing molecules that are produced in some normal biological processes in the body, and I come back to that, by mitochondria, and that are reactive, okay? They're very reactive, and they react with DNA, lipids, protein, and they damage them. And these are just examples of the products that you can obtain when these have reacted to various constituents of the cells. So they are free radicals, they're called also reactive oxygen species, all the same thing. There's these products, hydroxide, peroxide, and hydroxyl radical, and a few others, okay? And it's been proposed that these things, which have to be produced under normal physiological condition in all cells at some level, they damage the constituent of the cells, and this is the cause of aging. The hypothesis is a bit more complicated, but this still is the bottom line, okay? And so we were interested in wondering if that's the case, because we had in C. elegans, in worms, identified mutation, ISP1 and NEO6 here, that prolong lifespan a lot, and that affect the function of mitochondria, okay? And mitochondria are these energy-producing organelles we have in all our cells. That's where the fuel you consume is actually burned to produce ATP, to produce energy that you can use to move and talk. A lot of energy to talk. And it's produced mitochondria. And these genes are mitochondrial genes, and they affect the function of this little organelle which you have in cells. And here's where the reactive oxygen species are produced also in a major way. So we wondered, hey, for sure, these guys live long because they produce less reactive oxygen species, right? Makes sense. So, but when we actually measured them in purified mitochondria, purified this little thing out of cells, we find that they don't produce less reactive oxygen species, they produce more. Okay. I thought, that's very weird. They don't produce less reactive oxygen species. Although they live long, they produce more. And so to explore that more further, you also treated this mutant, which produced more reactive oxygen species, with antioxidants, right? Which you all spend a lot of money to consume uselessly and put on your faces. I'm being mean. And what happened is that it actually suppressed the long life of these. So at the concentration of antioxidant, we use NAC, N-acetylcysteine, or vitamin C. It has absolutely no effect on the wild type, on the normal worms. But on this long-lived worm, it suppressed. It prevented them from living long anymore. They now live just like the control, like the wild type. Antioxidant was suppressing the long life of these animals, which have high level of ROS. That doesn't suggest ROS cause aging, right? It's caused the absence of ROS, maybe it's not good for you. Okay? And it's even more true because what we managed to do is to mimic this effect by treating wild-type normal animal with a pro-oxidant, paraquat, which is a herbicide. It's toxic. Do not try it at home. It's bad. Okay? But it does produce free radical, and we use it in a controlled condition and in very, very small amounts as well, right? Not to kill weed. Okay, so, and when we do that, we actually prolong lifespan of normal animals a lot. But when we treat the mutants, of which we now think they live long thanks to the high reactive oxygen species, because when you suppress them, they don't live long anymore, it's not additive. You can't make them live any longer. So wild type, you can. So our conclusion really is that not only do reactive oxygen species, free radical, oxidative stress, the things which are meant to be combated by antioxidant, do not cause aging. They are actually involved in aging in a much more complex way, likely as molecules that are produced as stress responses in reaction to the damage that accumulates during aging. And we very much try to study this further. There we go. Go ahead.
Do you think that the last thing that we'll find when we eliminate all the causes of aging is that it's oxygen?
I think not. No, I think not. I think we could speculate on what the cause of aging is going to be. I think in the end it's going to be linked somehow to damage to DNA. Okay. How the damage you produce, I'm not sure. But I'm almost certain, personally, if not everybody's certain that it's not going to be reactive oxygen species, oxygen. It's not going to be this one cause. People have liked this hypothesis. for a number of good reasons. One of them was the perception that you cannot prevent the cells from producing free radical reactive species. And therefore, it's a good, you know, something you can't do anything about. It's a good thing to be a cause. Secondly, there's a very good correlation between how much free radical reactive oxygen species you produce and how old you are. Correlation is not causation, okay? But people, the human brain likes correlation, likes induction. Anything which looks comes together, you know, just off, it looks good. It looks like cause, but it's not, okay? The third reason, I think, why it was widely accepted is because we have also a natural impression that we should avoid toxic things. So proposing that something in your body is toxic, right, and that makes you age, that's a natural reaction. We have a whole program which gets us to try to avoid to eat toxic things, to do things that are bad for you. So the whole idea, you know, there's a compound, it's toxic, you produce it, and it makes you age, you know. And you know, look, more people, the older people are, the more they produce it. You know, this looked like very, very plausible, but was actually not formally tested. And only in the last 10 years or less, including our work and other people's work, this has been tested in a more scientific manner, okay? And it doesn't seem to be true. At least, again, not everybody agrees, but that's what I think.
So I think we could eventually move forever.
Different question. The fact that reactive oxygen species are not the cause of aging doesn't mean there is a cause I can't do anything about.
What's the linkage with those studies that have demonstrated that some organisms will live a lot longer if you restrict their food intake?
Absolutely. So many organisms, when you restrict their food intake, live longer. And the simplest answer to your question, we don't know why they live longer. I mean, we truly don't know. People have tried all sorts of things. We don't know. This is being studied in worms as well, and we do some work. And clearly, because you reduce food intake, I think it has something to do with mitochondrial function, just like our mutants, which live, some of them, very long, have abnormally functioning mitochondria. But again, I think it's probably not because they have low reactive oxygen species. Actually, there is a study which suggests, more than one, that suggests that calorie restriction food intake, also increases reactive oxygen species, just like in our mutants. Okay. And so this might be because reactive oxygen species turn on a stress response, which is beneficial because it's an answer of the organism to the stress of damage accumulating in the body.
Earlier you talked about the entropy was part of the equation. One of the laws of thermodynamics. In the 50s, it used to be that the total entropy in the world was constant. Now we know it's growing.
We sort of always knew it's growing.
Pardon?
We sort of already knew it's growing in the universe, but it could be constant in a small part of the universe. You know.
So nothing has changed, per se.
In terms of what we know about entropy?
Yes.
No. Entropy is bad for you. It's bad for the whole universe, okay? Everything falls apart. That's basically what it says. And the organism, use a lot of its energy to make this falling apart slow. But of course, the organism's function is also what makes it fall apart. That's why if you put them in liquid nitrogen and the organism does not function, also time passes, okay? It's not a time sink. Nothing happens. The organism doesn't damage itself and it doesn't have to be repaired, and entropy cannot really act. But nothing fundamental about the laws of physics, in terms of how we understand them, has changed. No, not really.
Two questions. One, in all these groups that you showed, there's the average lifespan group and the extended lifespan group. But in the extended lifespan group, in humans, maybe they have 50% more life. There might be some people who live up to 100, 110, but they don't live to 150, 200. Nematodes, maybe you can extend their life by 5 times, but not 50, 100, 200 times. So do you have any insight what's going on there? Is that, say, DNA process or damage process to DNA or something else happening that there seems to be another limit?
So,
and why is it different? between species.
Okay, so I have, so you seem to have several questions, actually. So one question is, it's not a question, I want to address the question, there's a difference between average lifespan and maximum lifespan. You know, you can just see, it goes back to the environment, say, okay, that average lifespan can be changed by making a better environment, by changing something small, which maybe removes one disease, and so on. So you change the average lifespan. But when everything starts, ends up kicking in, you haven't changed the maximum lifespan. The example with Alzheimer's worked as well. Okay, you escape all those, something else will get you, and as long as this something else is there, you won't live any longer. So yes, you have always to keep in mind that average lifespan and maximum lifespan might actually point to slightly different processes we're looking at. And that's why the holy grail for organisms where it's hard to get is to get changes in maximum lifespan. Why we have not really changed maximum lifespan in people, and actually in my slide centenarian specials, there were also the painter Tiziano who made it to 96 in the 16th century, okay? But you could change average lifespan, we don't know. Probably it's because people already live very long. And they live very long because their ecological niche requires a long life. Why? Because people take a very long time to develop. Okay? There's a lot of resources to make a 20-year-old. Believe me. Anyway. And it takes, probably it's such a delayed development because we live with our brains and it has to be filled, not enough to build it, okay? So it gives a niche where everything is slow and long. So it's no good to have all this F on 20 and fall dead at 21. So people have a very extended lifespan, okay? And hunter-gatherers probably, in prehistoric time made it to 50, you know, not bad. In spite of a pretty harsh environment. So there are not some people who made it to 150, I don't know. Why in general, which was your question as well, there's difference between species. We don't know if we can guess some things, okay? Nematodes, for example, have an alternative developmental path where they can become dormant. And in this dormant state, they can live a long time. Okay, and it would be no good to be dormant if you're going to die at the same time, right? So the idea of being dormant is that you prevented some of the things that's going to kill you. And it's possible in some of our manipulations here, we actually tap into that possibility. So it's already an intrinsic physiological possibility of this organism, and we tap into them, okay? And people don't have that. That might be one explanation. But for example, more recently, especially with our work with mitochondria, where we're not obviously tapping into that alternative thing, yet we obtain several fold increases. I don't know. So that's the other thing that's not known. And in general, the phenomenology of lifespan extension is complicated, and I couldn't speak about everything. For example, one thing I haven't shown is in all this, because I have no idea what's going on, in all these very long living strains, so some of the nematode things, I think five times longer, there are always single individual which makes it even much longer. Never happens in the wild type in the normal strain. Never. But as soon as you have strains that live longer, some, it's like the outliers. They go bang. They live like another twice longer. No idea what that means. Okay. I mean, it's something. Okay. And you haven't touched on your deep sea fishes and organisms that. So I think there is a distinction, because you said that was part of your question. I saw it in your eyes. A distinction that most of the organisms I've talked about, and we all age, they all have finite adult size. Okay? So once you have finite adult size, this finite organism can degrade. And those organisms seem to not age a whole lot, like some fishes and invertebrates, lobsters and carp, they grow forever. So by growing forever, they sort of apparently are capable of diluting the damage, okay? But it's not clear. I mean, like, you know, it's metaphorical almost. But organisms which do not have limited adult size seem to be able to age a lot slower.
These centenarians, when they do die, do they die the same thing as people who
okay, that's a very good question.
80s, 90s.
The problem is sometimes you can autopsy them or see what they die from, they are so far gone. They are so already, everything is different. It's pretty hard to actually diagnose what they actually died from. I mean, when you should die every minute. You know, half-life of centenarians is 6 months. When you're centenarians, you're going to die within 6 months on average. Okay, so all the organs, all the function are already run down a lot. When they actually die, it's very hard to say what they die from. Point one. Point two, their family don't let you even come close. So unless the family doctor just saw them die from a heart attack in front of them, you know, essentially this cannot be done. And that's the thing. That's what I tried to understand. They don't have obvious disease. Some do, and then when a centenarian develops an obvious disease, they're not going to live very long. Okay, that's why the centenarians, they would compress the disease, or even were never diagnosed with any one of them. You had a question?
Yeah.
Dr. Kim,
is it? Yes.
Yes, I asked my mom before. She did? What was your mom?
It was about 2 months time ago. Anyway, something that we learned at some point was that reactive oxygen is basically neurons are involved in pathology. Now, there's definitely a link to that, and mechanisms could be one mechanism is DNA damage. Not perhaps systematically an aging process, but the sort of DNA damage that leads to overproliferation of the cell, and then a population of cells that eventually leads to cancer. So I'm just wondering, because C. elegans is a remarkably simple organism, it shouldn't experience the sheer level or complexity of pathology that a human does. Therefore, pathology might not be as much of a factor in the lifespan of C. elegans. Now, reactive oxygen species since they're shown to be involved in pathology, wouldn't they reduce the average lifespan of humans more than C. elegans because pathology plays a greater role?
There are many assumptions in what you say. One assumption is how well it has been shown that reactive oxygen species actually contribute to pathology. I believe they probably will in some cases, and my interpretation is that reactive oxygen species act as a stress signal, but of course it can become maladaptive. You know, it's a stress signal to try to suppress the pathology. Pathology doesn't go away because there's other problems, and you produce more and more reactive oxygen species to try to fix something that's unfixable. Okay, and now you produce so many that they now participate in the pathology. So I think this, and one of the, I was mentioning why people like the reactive oxygen species theory of aging, and it has also to do that people have seen high level oxidative stress in pathology. But what's doing there, or whether it ever creates the pathology, I don't think we know that. That's also the difference between correlation. But I do believe that, you know, at some point this mechanism can go awry. And I don't have a problem with thinking that maybe in some cases, you know, the oxygen now end up participating in the pathology, even if they weren't there, if you want, in the first place to create the pathology. That's one thing. And the other thing about the difference between C. elegans and humans and pathology is that, I mean, I told you I didn't want to tell you about C. elegans pathology because it's gross, okay? They do have pathologies. It's just not necessarily the same pathologies. But they do still have things that go wrong with them. You recognize an old worm instantly, okay? I mean, it looks terrible. And so that is true. And the last point about that, you might be right. Maybe ROS causes human aging and doesn't cause worm aging. But the oxidative stress... But the oxidative stress theory of aging says oxidative stress causes aging, not human aging, not your neighbor's aging, but not yours, not my aging, that's why I take antioxidants. No, it causes aging. And we are looking out for, basic principles. And that gets me back to the very first thing I said almost, is for other basic principles, say development, homeoboxes, you name it, anything you want, signal transduction, anything you want, we find it's the same process as in all organisms. Or at least when you study them a lot, you recognize them. Before you know more, you don't see it that they're the same processes, right? And so there's no reason here that it should be different. But we know too, about humans, we know too much, okay? And that, and it blurs sometimes our ability to look at it clearly, and we feel involved too, right? And so all of that doesn't help.
Reactive oxygen species is not aging. I just said, it's even more simply than that, that it's going to associate with reduced lifespan. It may cause more aging, but in pathology, may cause an earlier death, even though people age less.
Yes, no, I mean, I really don't think, I didn't try to say that was wrong. Yes, I think that there are pathologies that do involve oxygen species as an aged organism, which now participate to early death. Very different from saying aging was caused by it, right? And which is what I was trying to find out, many people trying to find out. What's the cause? The, kind of primordial initial or cause.
What side of accidents? Is our date of death likely written in our genetic code?
Yes, but we've seen only, not very much, about 30% of it.
So what we do along the way, like how we try to stay
healthy. Oh, but what you do along the way is written in your genetic code. I mean, it's true. So, but from this data, this slide that shows the correlation of 30% monozygotic, it suggests that 30% of, it's hard to say it like that, 30% of your date of death, whatever that means, okay, is determined by your genes, who you were at birth. And the way it works is both physiological features, how you live, what you like to do, all of that. The way it, 30%. 70% is, we don't know where it comes from. Could be the environment, if you have a very bad environment. You know what I'm saying? It could be bad luck, could be something congenital, right? Which means that it happens to your development, it's not due to your gene, it's just an accident and ends up killing you. Don't really know. Wow, up there. Yeah.
I have two questions. Regarding the chart of aging when the subject had a child versus mortality, I was wondering, does this apply to both women and men? Because our they tend to have children later in life just because they're virile.
It's a very good question, actually, except if you think about it, the way a male fertility works, is different in two ways. One is much more the resources they can muster to actually decide to have another child, I mean, in historical time. But mostly, male sperm production goes down with age, but tends to be always a lot left or enough to actually desire children to a very high age. So, If this study was totally statistic with very large number of people, we could maybe see that, probably some 40-year-old on average sperm count has fallen down on average. It's on average harder to, you see what I'm saying? But it would be very hard to see that with a relatively small sample, okay? So I think it could quite be true, should be true, you know what I mean? But I think to actually, see this statistically, it's going to be a high order.
And then I have a second question about the graph. Why was it that we cut off at age 73 with the mortality? What happens to the people between 73 and 100 who die, say, at 85 years old?
Okay, so I cut out the slide, you mean? I was quick on it.
People who die at 73 and people who die at
75. Okay, it's just the difficulty of the study. Okay, so you have to pick an age, okay? And 73 is about the average age of when people die. But it's no good to take 30-year-old and ask if they had a child after they were 35. So they pick the actual age, of the average age. And it's very hard work to then, to go and identify an individual which is as much as you can equivalent to the centenarian you want to match, right? And who died 73 and so on. So yes, one could extend this study to all the age category and see how this relates, right? And then we could say, okay, maybe those who make it to 50 only, they didn't manage to have the child after age 22, you know? They were really fast aging, I mean, et cetera. So the point here is more like, was just to make this single point that here it's reproductive health, it might be health in general or physiological youth, you know, it's probably been through your entire life by that measure. Questions? Yes.
If I know it correctly, the worms, the mutants that live fourth and chamber, they are also living very inactive lives.
Yes.
So the quality of their lives. you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
This is the thing.
Do I want to live
120? I have a perfect answer to this. First of all, it's hard to interrogate the worms as to the quality of the lice. Secondly, there is no doubt that all these long-lived mutants would not survive in the wild. They would all... They're not adapted. They're mutants. They're not perfectly adapted to the environment. We look at them in special conditions. But that's important for us because that's the situation of people. Okay. So you speak about the quality of life of the worms because they live inactive lives. But the way we live, for the average robber baron of the 19th century, of the 12th century, we are like less than larvae. Okay. I mean, we sit in our ass day and night watching TV. I mean, what I do? I go home. After this, I go home. Okay. I eat. Drink, sit down, my TV, watch Netflix, okay? This is a very inactive life. And indeed, we make it to a very sane age. And we wouldn't want to live more active lives. Unless you try to be a professional sportsman or something, then you need all your energy. But the truth is that we are self-domesticated. We manipulate our environment to be environments where we can live very mutant lives, okay? We have already lost selection pressure on most things. And it's sort of interesting. Nobody knows what's going to happen that way on a long time basis. Actually interesting. quality of life is a relative concept. I mean, most people wouldn't mind not go to work and lie around in bed watching TV. Especially if you told them that makes them live long. Yes. That's not the question.
Is it possible to accelerate aging for a small period of time? I'm sure everyone's had the experience of meeting someone and then and not seeing them for 4 years, and in that 4 years it seems like they've aged 10 years.
It's mostly between 14 and 18, isn't it? But that is true. There's still phases in life where people change more, and this can be made partially programmed. But also when you have that impression of somebody who's already mature, I think it could be because they actually have developed some sort of disease, okay? And so then that affects your overall physiological health, and the way that it affects all the tissues of the body appears like age. It is age at some, you know, functional level. But I don't think, again, that, you know, the aging process, if we speculate that it's a separate processes from any of the pathological, you know, individual pathological processes is speeding up or not. Although I shouldn't say that, okay? Because, for example, what people have found is that people who had to undergo very heavy chemotherapy and radiation for cancer show many features which are associated with high age at a much younger age. So it's possible, actually, that these treatments induce damage which pretty much resemble aging. And in that sense, maybe we can be said that it has accelerated people's age.
Yes. I noticed on the graphs that you were showing earlier where you were comparing normal populations to a special population that lived longer. In one or two of those graphs in particular, a few of the population, the special population, were living much longer. The average, not somewhat longer, But then in that same population, there was a lot more early death.
Yes, this one population, that's particularly with mice, and there was some early death. And I actually surprised that we haven't seen more of that. Okay? Because just as I told you, all these mutants wouldn't make it out in the wild. Not a minute. I mean, we're talking seriously. And so what this means probably, one thing, interpretation, is that for most of our mutant studies or other people's mutant studies, we give them such a good environment that the inability to cope with the environment is not manifesting itself. And in this study, which is with mice, we might have changed their phenotype so profoundly, weakened them to survive a normal environment so profoundly in order to allow them to live long, that some even don't do it even in the cage in the animal facility because some bugs they can't survive is around. So I think this is real. I think this effect is real. And it probably means that for other studies when we don't see it, it's because we really managed to keep the environment in a good situation. Okay?
This idea of finite energy and only having a limited amount is used for reproduction or healing. Does that mean if we don't reproduce, we would live longer?
Oh, no, unfortunately. No. So, I mean, you probably would. Just first answer, it's not because your body is programmed in a certain fashion. It's not given the choice. And so it's made for both repair and reproduction. If you don't reproduce, it doesn't get more repair. And as I told you, childbirth has a slight shortening of lifespan, but it's a small effect, and I don't think even it's real, because again, it had to be calculated, and people are dead already, which means that their children, they had it at a much earlier time in terms of medical health and so on. I doubt that nowadays childbirth does anything negative, if anything is good for you. And so, but you don't get the choice, you know, you don't get to choose. I think that's the answer.
Do we know specifically what it is with these rodents that they can't reproduce? Is it unfit to survive in
virtual? Well, in some cases, we can guess. Some of the mutants we work on, they're sluggish, they eat slowly, they reproduce slowly, that's not a killer, I mean, in an evolutionary sense. It's pretty obvious. Others have a particular sensitivity to temperatures, so, you know, 25 degrees kills them, whereas the wild type, not. It depends, but it's always pretty obvious. Oh, definitely, all of them. And anybody who tells you they find a mutant which is identical to the wild type, just lives longer, is lying.
Well, the centenarians are not.
We don't know, because they had it. First of all, okay, centenarians, they live 15 years longer, not five times, okay? And so to appreciate, find out what about them is maybe misadaptive, okay, it's very hard. Secondly, misadaptation has to do with the environment. So, for example, this centenarian made it to 100 there in New England. This was a New England study. Maybe they wouldn't make it to 100 in India, okay, because part of their makeup makes them very sensitive to tuberculosis, okay? So we have to remember that all phenotype is the interaction of the genotype with the environment. You can't fully separate them, but...
From the 18th century, what I found striking is none of them died of infectious disease.
Okay, very good. A very good notion. There's two things to be said. We don't know that these people would live to 100 nowadays.
No.
Secondly, I do believe that personally, I have a personal model of what's going to happen to centenarians, what happens in centenarians, and I think it's the immune system, actually, which allows them to make it to 100, but that's just, we didn't discuss this. But the third point is, by doing modern genotyping study for SNPs and all this way to be able to compare people at the level of the genotype in great detail, what one has found is that not all centenarians are the same. So if you can find that centenarians are different from the other people in the group, but you take another group of people with centenarian in it, the difference is not the same. So, yeah. Yes.
in your discussion, you bring up a lot of Kaplan-Meier plots.
The what?
Kaplan-Meier plots. Proportion of individuals surviving strain. And a lot of them are central to the argument, I find. Well, to the experiment, at least, or at least to the statistics. Anyway, a lot of things cause death. But if we're interested in the process of aging, shouldn't we be looking at another metric again? I mean, it sounds kind of abstract. But you said you die by the first thing that kills you, and there are so many causes of death. Aging is just, like you might say, aging is one cause of death.
A couple of things to say. I used 8 death curves, as I show them, because they're easier for people to understand. We can't use mortality curves. It's much different. Mortality curves are things that go up like that. It's not so easy to take in as what it means in terms of the population for which we look at parameters. That's one point. And actually, there's some calculation we can only make on mortality curves. One cannot very easily make on death curves. That's one point I want to make about what you said. But the other thing is not exactly true what you're saying. There are also causes of death. Because, again, depending on which population we look at. But if you're not committing suicide and you are 5 years old, you have virtually no cause of death until you're 35. You probably do. You know, actuarial is good. You know, the cost of insurance, what speed it goes up. And it goes so far that if I'm 54, if somebody who's 64, he can be as sick as he wants. His life expectancy is greater than mine because he already made it to 64. That's the way it is. So in westernized society, we are killed by aging. It manifests itself with disease and stuff, okay? But we're living a very long time.
Mortality, the inverse mortality, Kaplan-Meier plot, whichever, for the centenarians, show that the mean age of this particular population, those that pass the threshold of being 100 years old, this arbitrary threshold, it becomes somewhat meaningless. It goes by some other metric other than, say, age. Maybe some effort should be put into discovering what that metric is. That would explain more of the variance between the two populations as opposed to just age. Because there's discrepancies that appears not to be so associated with age, otherwise we'd see more of a continuous kind of change that I would expect.
Okay, I mean, I don't think we want to discuss the math of this, which exists, and also demographic problems which have to do with this. One of the difficulties, this I can explain, people have to actually identify this sort of parameter and understand what's going on. It's two things. One is still the very small population of centenarians, and secondly is that centenarian doesn't mean the same anymore, because now people's average lifespan has increased so much that part of what we call centenarian is just the end of the distribution of normal lifespan. There you go.
Can we finish?
It's not me. I'm just answering questions.